As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and I thank you for joining us. With me in the studio today, I'm especially excited, as you can imagine, because I am joined by the very excellent Allison Rudd, and making the long, long trip from somewhere in East Anglia, it's James Scowcroft. Later on, we're going to be joined by our friend from north of the border, Mr. Graham Spears. We'll be talking a little Scotland and a bit of Tartan Army, who did not qualify, but I thought looked to be a little bit on an uptick. But of course, first, we need to talk about the team that did qualify for the World Cup. They wear the three lions on their shirt. They changed their badge a few years ago, and one of the lions looks a little bit camp to me. But that simply adds to the allure. So joining us now is Henry Winter, who I believe has just returned from Lithuania following that 1-0 victory. Henry, obviously with England already qualified, I'm guessing that certainly the impression was that Gareth Southgate treated this as an opportunity to try some new players and a new system. How do you feel about that?
I think it makes sense to play the new system, and I think we're going to see that increasingly over the six friendlies, and then at least they're guaranteed three games out at the World Cup next summer. So I think we're going to see it probably for the next nine games, the 3-4-3. My slight surprise when he did it last night was not that he was going to do it, because you think when Southgate played some of his best football with England, it was with the three with Hoddle and 98 and all that. So that's not the huge surprise. It slightly surprised me that he played Trippier and Kressel last night, because are they going to go to the World Cup? They're probably third choice at the moment, if you look at Klein and Walker on the right, and Bertrand and Rose on the left. So that's slightly surprised me. I thought, Walker, if you're going to do it, play Walker in that system. I was slightly surprised to see Dele Alli wide in a three. I'm not sure that really suits him. I think it's better sort of breaking four from a sort of central platform. And have England got six centre-halves to take to the World Cup if you're going to have sort of two for each position. So it was definitely worth trying, but not quite sure that the personnel necessarily suited it.
I completely take your point about Dele Alli playing behind. I kind of feel that if you do go three at the back and you have to play 3-4-1-2 or 3-4-2-1 perhaps, and then that means that if Harry Kane's your center forward, and then whatever, you put Sterling or maybe you put Rashford with him or whatever, but then you suddenly have an issue where you need to have a wing back who can cover the entire wing on his own and also provide the width. Do England have wing backs with those characteristics?
I like Walker and Rose. I can see them doing it, but we also remember when England last started with a sort of back three and wing backs was against Croatia, and it was 2006 under McLaren, and you had two very good fullbacks and in Ashley Cole and Gary Neville, and they were caught out, and that, you know, and they were, well, certainly Ashley Cole in my last 20 years of covering England has been England's most consistent player, and he was caught out. You look at the defenders England had there, which was Carragher, Terry and Ferdinand, who were better than anything England have got at the moment. They were caught out. Right, Bilic just tweaked his tactics and got behind England's wingbacks. So, look, that's history. That was, 9 years ago, but still, there are always lessons in history. And, you know, I do slightly worry about the system at the World Cup. I'm also slightly surprised that Southgate's been pretty adamant this is the way forward for England. I think he probably needs two systems. I don't think it's necessarily worth sort of declaring this is the system we're going to play. So when the draw is made on December the 1st, the opposition can immediately start working on how to combat 3-4-3. I think Rashford, I mean, I'm a huge Rashford fan. I think he can play anywhere across that front three, play up front on his own if he needs to, or he can play sort of on the left or on the right. Again, the Dele Alli is an issue, and Adam Lallana, where he comes in. And he was quite adamant that it will be a 3-4-3 rather than a 3-4-1-2. And we seem to be producing 10s at the moment, particularly if you look at the under-17s. There's some good potential number 10s sort of coming through. So, but as ever with England, we can talk about tactics, we can talk about technique, but ultimately it comes down to the psychology and the fact that they do tend to shrink when they put the senior shirts on.
Henry, I need help with some what seems to me false logic. Gareth Southgate said, of course, in order to qualify for Russia, we had to play 4-2-3-1. But of course, going forward, we will play three at the back. I actually genuinely don't see why you think playing 4-2-3-1 is the safe option against weaker teams and will get you there. And therefore, you leap to thinking that when you're playing more elite opposition, you would go to three at the back. As we don't have a sense of what English football is, surely we have to rely on a system that we're very comfortable with and stick with it, don't we?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, I much prefer a back four, not simply because it's the way that England players have been brought up, but I mean, I guess more of them are playing with a back three at the moment, and you would hope that they can be a bit more versatile. I just worry about if you're choosing a system which doesn't necessarily choose, certainly in central defence, the resources. I mean, you look at the centre-halves that England went to when England's defence was actually had a fantastic tournament. I think they only conceded a goal or two. Was the World Cup of 2006, and you had Carragher, you had Terry, you had Ferdinand, and you had, I think, Sol Campbell or Ledley King. I mean, it was a really, you know, it was a very good bunch of four centre-halves. When you look at it now, I think we're going to be struggling for cover if one of them gets injured. I like Stones. I can see the attraction of having him, particularly if he does step out into midfield more. But Maguire, I think, has got huge potential, but I think he's also got a mistake in him. I like Keane, but he can also get caught out of it. Cahill, and if you talk to Chelsea fans, they're not completely convinced by him at the moment, and some of them would like Christensen to step up and replace him. Jones is having a good season. Just hope he stays injury-free. And then Smalling as well. So there are Premier League defenders around, but I don't know. I just think England could be got out if they play back three. And then it also comes down to the quality of the midfielders in front of them. And that's why I hope Chalabar gets fit, gets in the squad, because I think England need that sort of protective presence. I know Henderson gets a lot of stick, but I mean, Harry Winks, you know, was deservedly praised for yesterday. I thought he was England's best player, along with Butland. So, you know, it's all about sort of defending as a unit as well. But I do slightly worry about the three at the back. And if you look at how Manchester City played against Chelsea when they used their full-backs, particularly Walker, to sort of come inside and attack the space between Chelsea's wing-backs and the sort of the flanking centre-half, you know, the system can be got at.
Henry, we know you have to leave us, so thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure. I'm not leaving you permanently, by the way. That sounds just because I watch England doesn't mean I'm at death's door.
And we're very grateful for that. Cheers, Henry. Safe travels. Let's go back to the 3-4-3. Henry makes, I think, a really good point. To play 3-4-3, maybe you don't need to bring six center backs to the World Cup. Maybe you get away with bringing five plus Dyer or four plus Dyer, maybe even. What struck me is, yeah, there's more teams in England playing three at the back. However, when you look at the personnel, obviously Cahill does it, and that's fine. Stones does it sometimes, although I'd argue that the way Manchester City play under Guardiola, correct me if I'm wrong, James, is very different to the way England play under Gareth Southgate. So no doubt that affects how the back three operates as well. But then the others, Jones and Smalling don't, if you want to consider them England internationals. Harry Maguire doesn't. Michael Keane doesn't. I'm not so sure it's such a natural evolution to 3-4-3. And I'll go further with the wingbacks. What he described there about Walker playing wingback and stepping into midfield against Chelsea for Manchester City, yeah, that's fine because it's Manchester City. He's not going to do that for England, because England have different players around them who make different movements.
Don't move at all.
Sometimes don't move much. The other guy he mentioned, Danny Rose, who can cover the whole flank on his own, right now he ain't covering squat because he hasn't played any football in 10 months. and I think the people most likely to replace them. I really like Klein when he comes back, but he's not really a wing back either. He's more of a defensive fullback, which is great. So was Ashley Cole back in the day on the other flank. Bertrand as well, not exactly a marauding fullback, although I think a very good defender. I'm not sure how joined up Southgate's thinking is here.
Well, he came out and said, didn't he, that he wanted to play three at the back for an extra body in midfield, and probably if a centre-half drives with the ball in midfield as well. You can get more bodies in midfield that ultimately will helpfully make England pass the ball better.
But so you have more sterile possession in midfield.
Yeah, basically, yes, exactly. So I just don't see three at the back. I don't think England are good enough for three at the back. And my massive, massive gripe for three at the back is, prime example was when Michael Keane's nearly scored an own goal. The gap between the centre-half and the middle centre-half to both his outside can be up to 30, 35 yards at times. If you play against a France that have a Mbappe, that have a Griezmann, that have a Dembele there, the bigger teams will just pick England off and, you know, we'll score goals against them. And I just don't think England technically are good enough in possession to dominate teams in midfield.
I'm amazed that this isn't getting more anger, to be quite honest. I mean, the whole point about Southgate's tenure is that he understands the pressures that wearing the shirt place upon players, particularly young ones. And he has said he's not going to ask players to do things they wouldn't do for their clubs. And it's about making sure they're all very comfortable in whatever system he chooses. So I just don't get why you nurture them in your first year as manager in a 4-2-3-1. Then you tell them, right, we're going to rip that up. And we've got Brazil and Germany next at Wembley next month. And we're going to play three at the back. Does no one else think this is slightly bizarre?
No, but I think he's had to make a change because England have been so limp recently and it's been so poor that you can't keep doing the same things. Now, making that change didn't make one bit of difference at all. It's the same sterile, pedestrian England. So
therefore, why add an extra bit of brain space to players that are already struggling with what it means to play for England?
Why announce now what you're going to do in 9 months' time when the situation could be entirely different?
Well, he doesn't know, does he? That's I think he's gone to change it because the home game recently when it was awful. The last two games, England have played against opposition that's been very poor. England goalkeeper has been the man of the match.
As somebody who's not English, what scares other countries when you play England is two things. One is set pieces and the idea of big people coming up, which is still why everybody just absolutely defecated in their underwear when every time Peter Crouch came on. It's like, oh my God, it's Peter Crouch. Seriously, like, if you really want to scare people, give yourself a chance. Bring Peter Crouch along. It doesn't matter. He's 50 years old. He doesn't run. All you should do is just stand there, and you're going to mess with the minds of foreign countries. I keep saying that. Nobody believes me. You think Peter Crouch is ugly and weird and deformed, and so you don't want him in your national team. Fine, right? But that's one thing. The other thing that scares people is pace, right? Because you've got players who run at people and run past them, and it goes all the way back to Michael Owen and in Rashford and Sterling. You've got people who do that. If you play 3-4-3, I think you lose a lot of that. And if you sacrifice it to possession in midfield, what, because you've got all these wonderful deep-lying creative midfielders like Dyer and Henderson? Did you see what I'm saying? Like,
absolutely.
It makes no sense to me.
Is there not an argument, and I know Mourinho does this now and again, if you're playing against weaker opposition, which they have done in every single one of their group games, because it's a very, very poor group that they're in, you go man for man. And if you're individually better, if you go man for man with the opposition, you should come out on top.
Yeah, but we're projecting forward to the World Cup, though, where you won't be...
That's exactly what I'm saying. So you're... Even when you go into the group stages of the World Cup, England aren't really going to come up... Well, they shouldn't come up against a decent side until the quarterfinals.
What about the
excuse me. No. Sorry. This is where I raise my voice, and I get stick for people saying, Gab, you mustn't talk over people and raise their voice. Why can't you be nice like those five live... Now, what did you just say? You just said England aren't going to come up against decent teams in the World Cup until the quarterfinals, right? This is what he just... You heard him, right, Alison? Now, maybe I should remind you who was in England's group last time around at the World Cup. It was Uruguay, Italy, and Costa Rica, who you guys all thought were pants, but then they kind of showed that actually no, they're pretty darn good. Right, would you really have wanted England to match up man for man against Uruguay and Italy at the World Cup 2014? Really?
Yeah, exactly.
You really think it was a good idea?
So you tell me how many Italy players are getting the England side now.
If I were the manager?
Yeah. You tell me.
Okay.
Right. Your knowledge is very good of Italy.
Oh, yeah, it certainly is, yeah. So, my combined...
Uruguay, would you have Cavani instead of Harry Kane? Would you have Suarez instead of Harry Kane?
Do you want me to sick the entire Liverpool fan base on you and the Barcelona? Of course I'd have Suarez. And I'd have them alongside each other. You don't need to play one striker.
Can't you tell me an Italian player that's getting in the England side at the moment?
Okay, I think Gigi Buffon would get in the England side. I think Bonucci would get in the England side. I think Chiellini would get in the England side. I think Verratti would get in the England side. I think Belotti would get in the England side. I think Insigne would get in the England side.
But Italy might not even be going to the World Cup as yet.
Yeah, exactly.
So they're that good.
Exactly. No, exactly. Oh,
sorry, we're with Spain. You're with Slovakia and the Seven Dwarves. Okay, fine. We need to detour over to Scotland because we're joined on the line by Graham Spears. Graham, how are you doing?
Hi, Gab. I'm fine. Well, I'm a bit depressed actually, but I'm okay. How are you?
We're good. We're all excited by Gareth Southgate's three at the back. I feel like, I don't know, halfway through qualifying, there was sort of this deep depression that you were going in, again, viewed from the outside, you were going nowhere, but you kind of ended this group on a high. I mean, other than the draw with Slovenia.
Other than the big low. It was a high.
No, but the results leading up to it all of a sudden seemed to improve. Am I wrong?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in the campaign, we got off to a terrible start. We drew at home against Lithuania at Hampden, and we were lucky to do that. We got an equaliser in the 89th minute. Then we went to Slovakia, and we got slaughtered 3-0 over there, and that was thoroughly merited. And then England beat us at Wembley. So we had something like, we had 3 points from our opening 12, or something like that. And we were struggling. But yeah, we picked up momentum. But I think Gordon Strachan was a bit lucky. We got a last-minute goal at home against Slovenia. We got a last-minute goal at home against Slovakia. We had a good away win against Lithuania. So it all came down to last night. We needed to go to Ljubljana and get a win against Slovenia, which would have guaranteed us second spot in the group and a playoff. But too many failings and capitulations early in the campaign, these were the undoing of Scotland and Gordon Strachan.
It strikes me, I mean, this is probably a familiar tone. When you're talking about a small country, and by the way, Graham, just so you know, I'm much more at the nature end of the scale than the nurture end. You're talking about a small country. You're talking about a not-so-large pool of players. You can, to some degree, you know, and you have done in the past, found Scottish grandparents for Matt Elliott and stuff like that. There's only so much you can do. I mean, star players are outliers, and if you don't have those two or three, and you're a nation the size of Scotland, there's only so much Gordon Strachan can do, or indeed the SFA. Is that fair? Am I being too kind to the little man and his employer?
Well, I mean, on that score, I've got no illusions about the limitations we have. I mean, we now, as a country, Scotland, which was once a great football country, once a really great football country, the land of Dennis Law and Graham Souness and Jimmy Johnston, 20 years without getting to an international finals. So something is deeply wrong. There's a systemic failure, and you cannot gloss over that. Gab, of course you're right. We're a country of 4.5 million people. We are a small country. We've got a small pool of players to call upon. But here's the thing. Wales is a small country. Slovakia is a small country. Northern Ireland is an extremely small country. Iceland is a small country. Iceland has a population roughly the same size as the population of Edinburgh. Small country syndrome has not stopped these countries from getting to major finals. So why does it only apply to us?
Was it a huge gaffe, Graham, that Strachan started talking about genetics? Maybe Iceland are the size of, as you say, Edinburgh, but, you know, they're all very, very, very clearly very genetically advanced, tall, muscular,
yeah,
good personality. Well, what's wrong? What's wrong with the Scots innately that they can't put a football team together?
Yeah, being called muscular has really helped Norway produce great footballers, hasn't it?
But it's interesting you should raise that genetics issue, because I was... I'm immediately, like we all are, you're totally ill at ease when football people start talking about genetics. You just, You just know they won't be qualified to talk about it. You know it sounds a bit dodgy. It just doesn't sound right. However, when I mentioned this so-called gaffe by Gordon Strachan about genetics to my wife last night, who's a doctor, she surprised me by saying, well, there might be something in it. And I said, you're kidding. And she said, no, genetics is linked to diet and the health of a nation, the physical health of a nation. She said Scotland historically has an atrocious health record of eating and smoking and drinking. And she said to me, it might not be ridiculous. There may be a link between the health of Scotland and its atrocious cardio and nutritional record and the genetics within the country. But Scotland does not have a microgenetics gene pool where our genetics are different from Northern Ireland or Wales or England or anyone else. But there could conceivably be some connection between the physiological health of the nation, diet and everything else, which in Scottish terms has been downright atrocious, and our ability today to produce great sportsmen. There might be some kind of complicated link somewhere there. That's all I'm saying.
Didn't you have the same gene pool in the 80s when you were producing Dalglish and Souness and those guys?
I presume we did, but I'm not a...
And I would imagine there was probably... Listen, the gene pool argument strikes me as bizarre, and the little people argument strikes me even more bizarre because, of course, Chile are one of the best teams in the world, although using the Scowcroft element, they may not qualify for the World Cup, but they won the Copa America, and they're all little people. Can it not just simply be randomness and the fact that stars are born randomly? Look, if Gareth Bale did not exist, Wales would not be going to the Euro. They wouldn't have gone to the last Euros. They wouldn't be going to this World Cup, right?
Absolutely. I know we can only take it so far. But it is a fact that in the 1960s, we had little men who were the best in the world. I'll give you two examples, Jimmy Johnson and Willie Henderson. So the Scottish wee man, the wee man of the past, reigned supreme and was brilliant. But Gab, it's beyond dispute now, I think, that what we find now is when Scotland clubs and the national team lines up to play games now, more and more my anecdotal evidence is that we are playing physically much bigger teams. And that's all I would say. We're playing much bigger teams where countries do what Scotland doesn't do. They produce players who are 6'3", who are brilliant, skillful, technical players. In Scotland, if you're 6'3", you can only be a centre-back. But in other countries, they seem to have diversified. But it's that we need to catch up on, I think, among the myriad other problems that have led to our footballing downfall.
It's funny because I always used to think of, the last Scotland team, I guess in 98, qualified for the World Cup. I always imagined that to be a team of little teeny tiny elves and big people, but not just at the back. I remember, Craig Burley and stuff. And it seemed like Paul Lambert was the only average sized person on the team. Yeah. And everybody else was.
I think he makes a good point. It's true, but the game in the last 20 years has physically moved on to the 6 foot midfield player now that you see in the Premier League, without doubt. And I'm not sure Scotland have. And if you look at a lot of the success that's coming with England, the younger age groups, and everyone's crowing about them at the moment, they're getting a lot of success because physically they're more advanced or they play the physically more advanced players.
I read a piece about this, and this might be something Scotland might want to invest in, is playing the FIFA rankings game so that you get seated in higher pots. Mm-hmm. You were pot four, right?
Yes, I think we were, yeah.
Pot four, and even though this was an easier group, it could have been a much tougher group. Mm-hmm. Northern Ireland have done really well in their draws, and they've done, whether by design or not. Certainly Switzerland was the ultimate case of people who they went, and James Gearbrandt wrote a piece about it for us maybe like a month ago, where they went and they hired some mathematics nerd who said, wait a minute, you guys are doing this all wrong. In your friendlies, this is who you should play, and this is where you should play them. And if you can do that, you will move up the rankings. Because that also makes such a difference. And then that has a knock-on effect, because then Northern Ireland, go to the Euros where they can put 10 guys behind the ball and they get points and they move up and it's worth more. And it kind of becomes almost self-fulfilling.
They haven't been in a difficult group here.
I've read many times that Northern Ireland in the last campaign had a kind of easier group. I don't know if that's true or not, but Gab, the thing we're dealing with in Scotland, I take all these arguments, all these things you're mentioning, we have had in Scotland catastrophic football decline. It's a bit like the great shipbuilding industry we once had in Scotland, decline. Coal mining, decline. Production of great football players, decline. Now, you can go through this campaign, Euro 16 campaign, this and that. Can you actually go through all 10 of them from 1998 and say, oh, well, you know, we might have made it? The overwhelming evidence is there has been catastrophic decline in Scottish football. We're all groping around trying to find out how to fix it, what to do, and the latest wheeze is genetics.
How much is the television money got to do with that?
Well, I mean, as you know, we are absolutely the impoverished relation when it comes to football money. With a kind of black humour in Scotland, it's often pointed out that Gary Lineker earns more presenting match of the day than the whole of Scottish football gets for certain TV deals that, you know, we get. You know, so we get peanuts. So that is one of the things. I mean, all I can say is that when I was a little kid, I played football 6 nights a week in the street, and all my friends did. And now we've got a guy like Andy Murray, who's a great tennis player. And in one way, even though I love football, there's a part of me that says, you know, I want Scotland to have a healthier, more multi-sport outlook. My little boys want to play rugby and tennis and badminton. I never ever imagined asking my dad in the 70s, can we go out and play badminton?
With the shuttlecock.
All I wanted to do was play football. So, you know, in one way, we're more multifaceted in Scotland. We play multi-sports. And in one way, we're a healthier nation for that regard. But the guy who's taken it in the pit of his stomach is football. It's football's loss, and we're trying to work out how to fix it. And it's all the more galling when we look at Wales and Northern Ireland getting to these finals, and we still can't do it.
Graham, two things. One is, do you think Gordon Strachan's going to stick around? And B, can you leave us with some positive, some reason to hope if you're a Scottish football fan?
Gosh, Gab, that's a tough question. I, on the Gordon Strachan issue, it's a hot topic here in our media and among the fans. Does he deserve to go on or does he not?
Does he want to as well?
Yeah, well, he might not want to. There's a lot of the job he's quite enjoyed. But if you go on the old line that two strikes and you're out, two failures and you're out. I mean, Euro 2016, we finished fourth in our group. And I think that was a bad failure by Gordon Strachan. We could have got ahead of Ireland. It was almost impossible. You know the way it was structured for Euro 2016? If you finished third in the group, you still got into playoff. It was almost impossible for Scotland not to make it, but we managed to finish fourth and not make it. And now he's failed in this World Cup qualifying campaign. So I think Gordon Strachan should step aside, give another guy a shot. On the terms of green shoots of recovery, I'm afraid I don't see any new stars coming along. So we need a clever, improvised coach bringing in new ideas who can make it work. And I hope that guy is out there somewhere.
It's easy to sack Gordon Strachan, though, isn't it? You just say, Gordon, you're not genetically predisposed to win anything.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
All right, I'm going to throw this out there. There was an article in The Guardian on Saturday which looked at sort of the cost of high-quality youth development, the human cost. In other words, kids who sign with Premier League academies and then they don't get offered a deal at 16 or they don't get offered a deal at 18 and then they become depressed and they haven't gone to school in the meantime, so they do worse, and or they haven't gone to real school. They've gone to, you know, football academy, play school. I wanted to submit to you, James, that what makes a country's football great and what is good for developing professional footballers isn't always good for developing kids. And there's always going to be this tension that the system, the way it's set up now, might be ideal to produce potential professional footballers, but maybe it doesn't do much good for the kids who don't make it, who are obviously the vast, vast majority. Is that fair? And then that there's a trade-off there.
No, I don't think it is fair. I don't... It's very easy to say this kid, all his problems in life are down because he was in an academy and he didn't get taken on. It's too easy to say that. Too easy. And I think you'll
find... Which, by the way, is not what I'm saying, but is what is implied in this article. But go ahead.
Having worked in an academy and seen the effect it has on kids, and I've seen it firsthand, and not only the kids, the parents as well, are just as heartbroken, really. I just think disappointment is part of life, and I see a lot of players now, if you're going to make it in football, the one thing that you can guarantee that will happen in football is disappointment. Now, if that's you're a pro player, a semi-pro player, at some stage you're going to experience disappointment, big disappointment of that as well. It's how you react. It's how these kids react, and I just don't think it's the academies around them.
I completely agree with you on the disappointment point. I wanted to become, as a kid, I wanted to become one of those sort of award-winning writers who writes for the New Yorker and writes three stories a year and write serious books. I didn't get that, and I was disappointed. Maybe you wanted to win a World Cup. Maybe you had other dreams too, Alice. And that's disappointment's part of life, and it happens in every walk of life. What I think is valid here is that pursuing football via an academy, there's an opportunity cost, right? Because I think I read in the piece that these kids, they train four times a week, and you know, if you factor in travel time and whatnot, they're probably devoting, 12 hours a week plus games on weekends?
It's at least, yeah.
And that's starting at what age?
Very young, 9.
Okay. So if my 9-year-old is spending, again, between games and travel time, 16 hours a week playing football and training, that is time that they're not devoting to other things, which is obviously schoolwork, friends, other interests they may have. It can stunt. It can stunt your development.
Well, let me stop you there. Okay, so you're saying to friends, they're going to make friends in the academy. So that's not really an argument. The academy's given them a structure.
Maybe they'll go volunteer with senior citizens and help them do their shopping.
Maybe.
Maybe they'll join a church group.
Possibly.
Maybe they'll be in the combined cadet force and do youth military
training. If we take inner cities, so we take London, for example, I think academies do very well. I think they educate these kids in a lot of things, not just football. In the ECCC now, part of it is their schooling. They have a psychologist that's there.
Sorry, what schooling? I don't know. I guess I don't know if the program's near enough, if it's been there, but how many of these people... Let's say you have a very clever academic kid.
Yeah.
He's not going to get the same schooling
so category one mm-hmm. club at 14, most of them will put their pupils in private schools who would never get an opportunity to go to a private school.
But you're talking specifically about the opportunities that are afforded. And actually, and this is, I think, is an interesting point. You're talking about it works very well for people who wouldn't otherwise have those schooling opportunities. But then what happens to the kid?
Social opportunities, Gab.
Okay, so let's take the kid from the disadvantaged background, because that's what people always bring up. So he gets to be 60. So he joins the academy and he's in the private school. And then at 16, he's released from the academy. Is there a commitment that he can continue at the private school and the academy keeps paying for him?
Right.
Or does he go back to the crummy school back home in his neighborhood?
He would go back to his neighborhood, but surely there's an argument to say that his education that he's had over the last 2-3 years is better than what he would have done.
Alison?
I find it hard to believe. How many of these kids are sent to good private schools?
Hundreds of them are.
Hundreds?
Yeah, literally hundreds of
them. And do they have to reach an academic standard to go?
No, it's part of the... it's most Cat 1.
So if they don't have to reach an academic standard to go to the private school, no, they're so not going to fit in at the private school?
No, so a club will have a tie-in with a private school. And what they'll do, they'll go there, they'll probably lodge there as well. So they'll go training in the morning and they'll go to the private school in the afternoon and have a dedicated teacher that will teach them.
Okay, so that's an entirely normal school experience, right? Do they go to the school and it becomes like a little, I didn't realise so this,
they
becomes
the
like
same,
a little
they get the same hours of education that a normal child
Yeah, but
would
they're
get.
In the class with all the other kids from the football. I assume the normal children go to school
yes
in the morning,
no.
not in the afternoon.
Yes and no.
I don't
so
know.
Some classes are mixed, some classes are with the football children.
I don't know that that's necessarily a normal, I mean... Hey, I didn't go to
normal.
Didn't go to English private school. Did you? I mean, tell me that's not normal, right? They're in a little ghetto within their private school, basically.
It proves what James is saying proves that the elite program values education and they're trying
That's
to make sure it's not.
It's you would
they're
not believe.
Churning out kids that have completely neglected their ability to do maths
and
English
and
so
have
on.
An exit
but it
plan.
Still doesn't. The central point that Gab was getting at was that you're still creating a world. That isn't the average world for a kid, and if they're dumped from it, they have to cope with what they're left with. And I would suggest
that
it's lovely at the time, perhaps, I don't know, to be sent to a private school, even though you're probably not very bright, but they feel you ought to go. Your life and your timetable and the way you feel about what you want to achieve each week, if you cut all that by being rejected, it will leave you in a very peculiar place because you haven't had a normal childhood and the people that you're going to now be hanging out with will have such different experiences and you will feel labelled a failure where they're still growing and learning what they can become. You've got nothing left. It's surely the problem.
I totally disagree with that. And I'm not sure what is a normal childhood, how you judge that. I think academies give a wonderful structure to kids to come in. They learn not only the football but the discipline that's shown in academies you don't get in school. A lot of them don't get in homes. Most clubs have to have an exit plan, so they don't just kick them out. They work with the kids to try and find education or a grassroots club for them to go into. Going back to the disappointment factor, kids will get disappointment. They'll get disappointment in their school grades. How
leave the disappointment because I think we're all in agreement on the disappointment factor.
No, but that's the whole point. The thing is, how do kids?
Yes, I know. And some guy committed suicide, and it's sad, and there could be
awful,
a million factors.
Right?
That's all terrible.
Kids do commit other suicide.
I am wondering about whether the system, as it's geared, and I think this is an angel bugbear of mine is, if you go to other countries in Europe, let alone South America. Professional footballers come from all sorts of backgrounds. Here in England, and I know it's changing and people will mention James Ward-Prowse because he has a double-barreled last name, I guess, or whatever. I'd argue, until very recently, 99.9% of professional footballers came from working-class backgrounds or lower. It was really difficult for middle-class kids, let alone upper-class kids.
Where's your evidence based on that?
Okay, how many footballers... With the exception, I mean, before you mentioned Frank Lampard, with the exception of ones whose parents were professional footballers, how many footballers have you met who you would describe as upper middle class in background?
More than you think.
Can you just name them? I know. I have no problem.
Why?
What
do you describe as upper middle class? What's...
White collar parents. ABC1.
What, that
if
come
you
from
prefer
privately
that.
Educated...
Not to say privately... Look, this is a country that's obsessed with class, right? People whose parents are doctors and solicitors and bankers and things like that. I think part of the reason, actually, part of the historic underachievement, and Simon Cooper actually pointed this out as well, in England, is that your football-playing population, the ones which actually had a pathway in, was actually limited to not 50 million English people, but... probably 25, 30 million. Because there's a lot of people who just, because of the way the system is, find it very difficult to combine studies as a plan B and playing high-level football. Certain entire categories of people simply did not historically have a pathway into football. Who was the poshest person you were, who was in your team, in your academy team at Ipswich? It was you, wasn't it? No, I'm serious.
Possibly.
Exactly. Yeah, but the private
schools don't really play football, so you can't.
So you have entire populations of people who don't get into the system, whereas in other countries.
But that's not football's fault. But
what I'm saying is, in other countries, you have situations where you can play. You can go to a very good school, go to a fancy school, without being particularly clever, but you can go to fancy school and be on a pathway for business class-oriented success and also play football to a very high level at youth level. And that's something which we had this conversation with Matt Dickinson a while ago, that's something that they're trying to change in England, but it's still very much
a
process.
It is changing. There are some schools which have
it's not dedication.
Good, dedication. No, there are some private schools that have good academic standards, and they have academy structures. So they have links to the local football clubs, and they make sure that the FA are happy with the way that they run. So in a sense, they are an academy within a school. So the kids do not have to travel to training and for physio work and coaching. It's been going. This all started about five, six, seven years ago.
So I would argue,
and it's growing.
I would argue it's new, and we're only going to see the results of this in a few years.
Yeah, well, on every level, it makes sense, doesn't it? If you can study and learn football without those long, long trips. I mean, yeah, and what it does to the family as well. If you invest in a kid that you think is going to succeed, and it requires 4 hours commuting. 3 or 4 times a week, eating in the car, no time to do homework because you think your kid might have what it takes to be a success at.
And when the kid's 14, and if you can do basic maths, you figure out that the chances of him or her making it are so tiny, you're going to hedge your bet and say, no, actually, you're going to go to school so that you can go to university so that you've got a plan B if it doesn't work out.
So there's no to make it as a professional footballer, you do need to put the hours of practice. It's not going to come from an hour a week.
10,000 hours, right?
Well,
joking. Sorry.
You do need to put the hours in. Yeah, if you go to university, is there a guarantee that you're going to end up with a top job? No.
No, but your odds are simply are going to be substantially
better. Well, your odds
substantially
are higher if you go into a football academy or if you don't go into a football
they
academy.
They are much higher, but the odds of making it as a professional footballer are much, much smaller than the odds of having a decent job if you go to university. I mean, I think this is just pure math. There's just more decent jobs out there than there are Premier League jobs for English people. I mean, on a societal level, when people say the FA should do more, right? Should the FA put more money into elite youth development, or should it put more money into development over 40s, women, blind people, amputees, just simply recreational football? I mean, these are basic choices that people make, right?
I think what they should do, and I know for a fact they do it in France, is that the gap between academies now and grassroots football is very, very big. So they need to put more money into grassroots football to make... So if you do get released at 12 or it's 14, that you can go into a very, very good grassroots.
I'm completely surprised with that. We need to move on because guess what? It's time for quick hits. Mehran Fellaini picks up an injury in Belgium's 4-2 win in Bosnia and will be out for a few weeks. That means he'll miss the clash with Liverpool this weekend. Scoey, given that Carrick and Pogba are already out, are you worried yet?
Fellaini's a big miss. He's been an integral part of Manchester United in recent weeks, scoring some crucial goals. He will be a big blow in that game. And
terrified.
I think a little bit.
Mohamed Salah scores a last-ditch penalty to send Egypt to their first World Cup since 1990, which, given that they won 4 African Cup of Nations in that time frame, is pretty darn remarkable. Alisson, are you ready to anoint him as the Premier League newcomer of the summer?
Maybe. There's something
magical about Salah.
There's something frustrating about him in that I know he can be better than that. there's so many instances in which he gets there where most other players wouldn't get there to the goal-scoring position. All it needs is a simple pass to set up the goal. And it's as if the oxygen has left his brain and he still makes too many of the wrong decisions. But overall, yeah, he's had a great few months.
Scores a penalty with all the pressure in the world on him in the fifth minute of injury time. That's pretty impressive. Wales host the Republic of Ireland in what could well amount to a playoff to reach the playoffs. Scoey, you're a neutral. You don't have any Welsh or Irish in you, do you?
No.
Good. You're entirely impartial here. Not who do you think will win. Who would you rather see at the World Cup? Who do you like more, the Welsh or the Irish?
That's a difficult question. I'd go for Wales. I think Wales play slightly better football. More attractive to watch.
Do you like Chris Coleman more than Martin O'Neill?
No, not really. I'm not a fan or dislike any of them. I just think Wales are...
You must have played against Chris Coleman.
I have played against Chris
Coleman.
Did he kick
you?
Yes, he did kick me.
Cristiano Ronaldo comes on and scores against Andorra to bring his all-time goal-scoring total to 70. Or maybe 78, actually. Maybe it's more than that. I don't know. It's a lot, anyway. Allison, he's joint fourth all-time, and I'm going to name some names here, alongside Godfrey Chitalu of Zambia. He's behind Japan's Kunishige Kumamoto, Hungary's Ferenc Puskas, and Iran's Ali Dai. Do these numbers mean anything, or is it all apples and oranges, given it's international football?
Yeah, well, clearly you've named players that didn't do as much as Cristiano's done on the trophy front for his club. But for all his glitz, glamour and the stuff about him as an icon and his self-awareness as someone who should be fated, basically he's reliable and he delivers. And that's what those figures mean, is that he turns up and plays for his country and he's reliable, and you can't ask for more than that.
He's not far behind Puskas, and I'm pretty sure he will retire as Europe's greatest ever international goal scorer, which I still think is still pretty darn remarkable.
Europe's greatest ever player.
Does Eusebio count as European, given he was born in Mozambique? The argument would be Cruyff, right? That would be...
Ronaldo in front of
person Cruyff. In the conversation, right? Yeah, possibly. The six biggest Premier League clubs want a bigger share of Premier League overseas TV money, which is currently shared out equally, unlike domestic TV revenue, which is merit-based, albeit with a very egalitarian factor of 1.5 to 1. Scoey, do the big boys have a point, or are they just being greedy?
I think they're being both. I think they do have a point. I think they're also being greedy. Let's be honest, a lot of people globally want to turn in and watch Manchester United, don't they? They don't really want to watch anyone else. So hand the money over.
So they're not greedy. They have a point. I mean, a club like Manchester United spends a ton of money becoming an established Premier League brand around the world, blah, blah, blah. Especially now that the overseas contract is so big. Huddersfield get promoted 6 months ago and, hey, look, we're going to get an equal share to United. Exactly. That's the part that's, you know, I know they're all about greed, but they kind of have a point in some ways. Mesut Ozil keeps getting linked with a January move away from the Arsenal. Allison, would you just cash in on him, or would you rather let him go on a free in the summer and hope that he contributes something between now and June?
You need more than hope that he contributes. There's nothing wrong in principle in letting a player see out his contract if you feel in that time period he is an asset. But I don't see any evidence that Ozil is growing. It looks to me like he is personally ready for a change. So in that case, you may as well cash in January. And I have a question for you, Gab.
Ooh.
Are we really in danger of there being a World Cup with no Lionel Messi in it?
Indeed we are. And Tuesday night, absolutely huge. Argentina are going to Ecuador, where they've won just once in their last 10 attempts. And they need to win this game to be guaranteed a spot at the World Cup. A draw would leave them dependent on a whole bunch of other results. If you're in the Scepter Dial, I invite you all to find somebody under the age of 30 who can show you how to do it and stay up and watch this, because I really think it's going to be an epic night of South American qualifying. Brazil still are the only team entirely mathematically guaranteed of going, and there's another seven teams scrambling for the three automatic spots and the playoff spot. I'll say this about Messi. In qualifying, Argentina played 17 games. Messi's played in 9 of them. In those 9 games, they gained 18 points. In the 8 games that he has not played, they've only gained 7 points. And I think when people question Messi, I think there's your answer right there. Argentina are really bad without him. That's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my excellent guests, Graham Spears, Henry Winter, Alison Rudd, and James Scowcroft. Remember, it's just £8 for an 8-week trial. You can search The Times online. And from this season, you can access highlights of every single game in the Premier League, Champions League, and Europa League. And also from the third round, the FA Cup. The Premier League returns, and so shall the podcast next Monday. Although I won't be here. I am taking a week off. So there. We'll be looking back at, among other things, Liverpool against Manchester United.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.